Hello, Potterheads. Faherty here with a special podcast for your listening pleasure. In 2011, I moseyed up to Kansas to meet with my dear friend Tom Watson. He's clearly in love with the game, but the game didn't always love him back. He had chances to win majors early in his career, but was tortured by his inability to close the deal. But with a combination of dogged Midwestern determination and his unusually high intellect, he tore that label off and frequently beat the world's best. Since this interview, old Tom doesn't play quite as much as he used to, but that doesn't mean he's slowing down any. He's still out there competing with the old farts, so if you're going to waste part of your day listening to this, pay attention. You just might learn something.
Tell me how you started playing.
95% of the players were started by their dads. You know, I was no different. My dad was a really good amateur player, played in the National Amateur two or three times. He did pretty well once up in Iowa, and he had a great passion for the game. His friends had a great passion for the game.
Was he tough on you?
Yeah, Dad was tough. He didn't suffer fools very gladly, and he didn't suffer a mishit shot. When I played a shot in the golf course, if I hit it in the toe and ended up four feet from the hole, he said, "Yeah, you got lucky there."
He knew.
He could hear by the the sound.
So he was a good player.
He was a darn good player.
And could he tell by the body language afterwards as well? Well, because your body language, you were unique to me, because I could never tell whether you were shooting 66 or 76. You walked the same. You had the same idiotic grin in your face, like you were, you were enjoying this.
Yeah, you didn't hear what I was muttering under my breath when I was playing
badly.
What
was going on inside your head?
Well, when you're playing badly, you'd get upset with yourself. And, Dad would see me after making a bad hole. He'd see me hit as hard as I could the next tee ball. Say, "Yeah, there's a little RA in that one, wasn't there, son?"
That would be red ass.
Yeah.
Did you caddy for him?
I did caddy for him, and his best friend Bob Willits gave me the moniker of Flytrap Finnegan, the world's worst caddy.
Oh, the world's worst caddy? Yeah. And where was this? Was it country club?
Well, I grew up here in Kansas City, and my dad was a member of the Kansas City Country Club, and I started playing golf there, all for Foremost ice cream sandwiches. That was the treat that we would get to get out of their hair when they were. At the end of the day, they were in having a cocktail, and we kids were out there, and they would they'd say, "All right, boys, Ridge and myself, go out to the putting green and behave yourself. And if you behave yourself, you get a Foremost ice cream sandwich." So that was kind of my first treat if I went out there. But I loved to play, and I loved the challenge of putting. And one of the reasons I became a good putter was that I always tried to beat my older brother, and on the putting green was the first place I tried to beat him.
And your mom, how did she look upon this golf game? You were hanging out with your dad, he was going to the bar and you were on the putting green. It's kind of similar to my story. My dad would go to the men's bar and I'd be out on the putting green with my German Shepherd and a club orange. That was my treat. Was like an orange aid.
Yeah.
And I just ended up practicing and being in the way a lot of the time.
Well, I don't think I was ever in the way too much on the golf course because Dad taught me how to play the game, the etiquette of the game early. You can't run, you can't yell or scream, you can't throw your clubs. I did throw my clubs when I was a kid.
You did, didn't you?
I had a few helicopters out there, but I learned that the kind of the expensive lesson that you break a club, it costs you $10. I didn't have $10.
A big part of Tom Watson's career were the caddies that he chose. He had Alfie Files at the British Open, and of course, there was the delightful Bruce Edwards for most of his PGA Tour career. Now, those men are all well and good if you want actual information about actual golf, but I chose caddies for a different reason. I needed entertainment value. So, Rodney Wooler, he caddied for me for 13 years, and I can honestly say that I probably could have fired him on every single occasion. Rodney once showed up at the Scottish Open, which I had won the year before and had promptly lost the trophy, which is the oldest trophy in professional sport. I'm not proud of it, but that's just the way that it happened. There was at least one member of Led Zeppelin involved, I can tell you. Rodney had rented a moped and had taken to doing that on a regular basis, so he was a familiar figure. about all 320 pounds of them on this tiny moped. Well, the night before, Rodney had been staying in the village of Auchterarder, and the Star Pub is a famous pub there, and it's where all the caddies hang out. And he'd been in the Star Pub and had drunk about 17 pints of McEwan's, which was an average night for Rodney. And he ordered a microwavable seafood pizza. Not a good idea. I mean, we're talking about clams, mussels, you know, cockles, winkles. Well, they're called bivalves, these animals, because they suck it in one end and they blow it out the other. If it looks like it should be in your handkerchief, don't eat it, all right? General rule of thumb. Rodney had eaten all of this pizza except one slice, which he decided he would keep for later. So he put the slice of pizza into his helmet, got on the moped, whoosh, on with a helmet, up the street to his digs. He wakes up 20 minutes before my tea time. Oh God, you know, like straight out the door, you know, onto the moped, you know, down, and I can hear him coming. He takes off the helmet, you know, and he puts it in, he ties it all up, and he gets himself straight, and he comes walking up towards the putting green. I'm standing there, practice putting, and he gets closer, and I'm thinking, what in the hell has he done to his head? He had hair yesterday. You know, my God, he's gone bald. I said, why have you got a slice of pizza on your head? I've often wondered just how far a caddy could go into a round with a slice of pizza on his head. And he takes it off, and it's like Velcro, to like that. And there's a shrimp hanging from his ear, like an earring, you know. And he says, I haven't had breakfast yet. And takes a bite out of it, you know. I'm like... Tom, it's a day after your 14th major win. You won the senior PGA Tour, 8 on the regular tour, 6 on the senior tour. Does it ever feel any different?
No, it doesn't. And honestly, when I first won my first tournament, I think the euphoria was greater than it is now, but the sense of accomplishment, the sense of getting the job done is always there. And that's what I always try to do. I try to go into a golf tournament, not making as many mistakes as the next guy and trying to win a golf tournament.
But what is it that keeps you going? I mean, I know you love to play golf. Is it the competition?
It is. It's the competition. I enjoy the being in the arena. I enjoy being in front of people hitting shots that really mean something when the chips are down, when you're coming down the stretch. I guess I judge my career based on the shots that I played when I really had to play them, and whether I hit a good shot or a bad shot.
You had difficulty winning to start off with. I mean, you had a bunch of chances early on in your career. You know, you kind of got labeled as a guy that...
I choked it away.
Might not get there.
I choked it away. I had trouble. I didn't learn how to win until I got on the tour.
When was it in your career that you felt that you'd found out what you needed to find out? Or, I mean, are you even there yet?
I have to go back to my childhood and my upbringing in the game of golf. What really gave me the passion for winning was being around my dad and his friends, but also around people like Stan Thirsk, who I've been around for years. He was the pro of the Kansas City Country Club. Monday morning, all the clubs are closed. But I knew that all the pros used to go out and play golf somewhere. And you go out and have gambling games and have dinner afterwards. And I got a call one time from Stan and said, Tom, because I'd come out and play golf with us guys today. I think I was 13 or 14 or something like that. And I said, would I?
What was your handicap?
And that started, I was about a one back then, 13, 14. I was a scratch or one, plus one or something like that. But I remember going out and playing with these guys. And it was just, Stan was my partner, and Stan was a great player. And I made a few putts, and I was basically trying to show off. I was a shy kid, and one of the ways that I could express myself was through playing golf and showing people, I can do it. You know, look at this shot. I wanted that approval, I think, saying, Tom, that was a great shot. One of the things that those pros, when I played with those guys on Monday, they tell me stories about playing on the tour, because they all played on the tour. And what they told me, and I asked the question when I turned pro, I said, what one thing will help me be a good golfer? And all of them said this all independently, it wasn't in a group. They said, go and watch and play with the best players.
How did you react when you didn't play well? You're a kid amongst men.
I cried.
You did?
I'll never forget crying when I shot 81 and when I was 13, playing in the Kansas City men's medal play. I shot a pretty good first round, but then I shot an 81 in the second round. And I remember coming up the 18th hole, I was crying, and Jack House, with whom I was playing, he was from Milburn over here. He came up, put his arm on my shoulder and said, "That's all right. You're a good player, and you know, it's just a bad day." But you know, it affected me, you know, playing badly, and that's one of the reasons getting back to learning how to win, learning how to deal with the pressure, that I give a lot of credit to, that I just hated to lose. And by hating to lose, I learned how to win.
I grew up with my father's friends in a similar way, my Uncle Weston, my Uncle Jack, my Uncle Sam. Only one of them was a real uncle, but I loved them. I loved caddying for them, being around them. They were funny, and they encouraged me, and at the end, they gave me a few pounds to start off as a pro. They believed in me, and I was a 5 handicap. You see these kids coming off the conveyor belt, college conveyor belt, with an entourage these days. It's totally different. It's, in some ways, I think it's harder for them.
I think the mentors have been replaced by coaches of different sorts. The swing coaches, the mental coaches, the physical training coaches.
Entourage.
Yeah, and it was funny. I think it was, where was it, at Birkdale. We walked to the practice tee, and Neil Oxman, my wonderful caddy, he's at the practice tee, and I'm signing autographs. And I walk out kind of in the open like this, and I'm walking toward Neil, and I'm going to walk past him. He said, "Stop!" And I go, "What do you mean, stop?" And he said, "Look at this practice tee." And you had maybe 30 players hitting practice shots. Each one had 5 or 6 coaches and people behind going like this, you know, manufacturing representatives, all we just talked about. And then there was Greg Norman, he and his caddy.
Yeah.
And said, "Greg and you are the only guys out here without an entourage." And I think, listen, if it works, it works for these players.
Yeah.
To go and rely on coaches and these things to help them out. We just did it differently.
Yeah.
We watched these players practice. I mean, when we went on the practice tee, we're hitting balls, and on the tee walked Sam. Everybody would be hitting balls like this, and then all of a sudden have some sort of reason to go over their bag, you know, change gloves. But really what they're doing, they're watching Sam swing the golf club.
Yeah.
When he walked on the tee, I just quit practicing. I went right behind him and just watched him.
Yeah.
I watched him the whole time.
Yeah.
Till he quit. Because he gave me the rhythm that helped my golf swing. I know that.
But that's the advice that you were given?
That's right. Exactly. That's the advice. Watch the best players play for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, this game can be made too complicated.
Oh, no kidding.
And I think a lot of the players today make it too complicated.
Late in 1976, Tom Watson was struggling with a lack of consistency, and his reputation as a choker was firming up. But during a late-season Pro-Am event in Japan, Watson found his mojo and his swing, propelling him into 1977 with 2 early-season wins. First, the Crosby in Pebble Beach. Next, the San Diego Open.
And then came the Masters. And it came down to Jack and me in the last few holes. And I made a putt at 17, Jack blinked at 18, and I won my first Masters. And then from the Masters through the U.S. Open and then into the British Open at Turnberry. It was one heck of a tournament between Jack and me the last couple of rounds when we shot lights out and lapped the field.
The greatest weekend maybe in the history of major championship golf. What was your relationship like with him then compared to what it is now? Because I know you're great friends. You do a lot of things together.
And our relationship back then was button heads.
Yeah.
Here's this snot-nosed kid and doesn't know how to win. He's a choker. Comes up, wait a minute, he beats me in the Masters. Yeah, I got lucky. And then then we play the last two rounds together at the Open at Turnberry, 77. The last hole was, it's still a story because I hit first and I hit a 1-iron off the tee and I pull it a little bit and there's 2 bunkers down there, or at least 1 bunker back then. And I was worried about it going in that bunker, but it skirted the edge and it was actually perfect because it's a dog leg left. Jack took a driver out. And it's not a driver hole for Jack because he fades the ball and it's right to left. But he hit this drive and hits this is right, the shot goes way off to the right like this, and it's going toward the crowd and the bushes and over there. And you just don't know what happened to it. Nobody knew, walking off the tee. So I walk up, find my ball over here, and I wanted to know what I had to do. And so I walked all the way over to see Jack. I went from here to there, looked at his lie. He was in grass about that deep, this far from unplayable. Gorse bush was just beyond his ball, but he's in grass this deep.
And Jack is already there? So you're walking over?
Well, I don't know if Jack was there or not, but I wanted to see what my situation was. So I walk over the ball, see it's in grass this deep. So I go back and hit a 7-iron, hit it right on the nose, and I hit it right at the flag. I don't know how far it is from the hole, but the crowd seemed to like it a lot. Jack, he takes his swing. I mean, he hits it as hard as he could. And there's this much grass at the end of his club going through like this. And here comes the ball. It's tumbling out like this. It doesn't have any spin on it. It's tumbling out. It's going to the right edge of the green. And I said, well, there's a little right slope right there. It's going to kick off the green over there. No, it kicks straight, and it hops over the slope and rolls up on the edge of the green. We were walking up there with Alfie Files is my caddy. He gets up there, and he looks up at me like this. He's carrying the bag, and he said, well, sir, you got him now. And I look over to Alf, and I said, Alf, he's going to hole it. Alf goes, kind of like your crazy eyes. He gave me those crazy eyes like this. And we walk up to the green. It's close, and I was just concerned about how close my ball was. Because I had to think that he was going to make this putt, the greatest player in the world. And I'm walking up there, and it gets closer. You love those shots. It gets closer as you walk.
Yeah.
And it was about this far from the hole. It was perfect distance.
Mm-hmm.
And we go up there, and the crowd quiets, and Jack gets up there, and goes in there, and the crowd just goes bananas. And just a loud, loud cheer.
The hair standing up on my forehead,
and,
thinking about it.
I mean, it was something. And they're cheering, And I said, let's get this over with. And I get back there and line it up, and Jack puts his hands up like this. And the beauty of the game of golf,
mm-hmm.
It is the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It's unique. Everybody in that 20,000 people or 15,000 people, they went silent.
They gave you your chance?
Gave me my chance. And I went up there and knocked it in the right center of the hole. And it went in. I raised my hands in victory. That's euphoria. That's euphoric.
Yeah.
But what Jack said coming off the green, he grabs me by the neck. And I mean, it's not just a like this. He grabs me like this. Walking off the green, and said, Tom, I gave you my best shot, but it wasn't good enough.
Was that the turning
congratulations.
Point?
Congratulations. That was the turning point in my my psyche there, then and there, about whether I could play the game with the big boys.
From 1977 at Turnberry, 33 years later, you find yourself in a position where you can win your sixth Open Championship, and not just all of Scotland. The whole world is behind you. I have never been so frightened watching a television set in my life. I couldn't bring myself to believe that you were going to do it until the final couple of holes, and I thought, he's really going to do this. It would have been the greatest feat in the history of golf.
Honestly, I don't think about that, because that's the beauty and the tragedy of this game we play.
Everybody that loves
and everybody
you
who plays the
thinks
game
about
has
that.
The same thing happen to them. I mean,
they don't.
Yes, they do.
No, they don't.
Yeah,
they win
do.
Five
Come
Open
on.
Championships and then have that kind of a chance and hit those two beautiful shots and not win your sixth.
Everybody plays the game has hit a perfect shot that came out lousy, and everybody's played the game has hit a lousy shot that came out perfect. And that's the way you have to look at it. Going into that week, I was playing really well from tee to green, and I'm in the hotel with Hillary. And at night, after dinner, I said, I can win this tournament. And Hillary goes, mm-hmm. it's like anybody else. I can win this tournament. Mm-hmm. Sure.
But that's what I said to the press. Had she heard that before?
Probably never.
Yeah.
This one, I said, I had a really good feeling about I could win this tournament. And the reason is I was playing my best. But I was playing a golf course on which I could compete. It wasn't too long. And number three, and most importantly, I had played in, that was my sixth major championship playing at Turnberry, where most of the kids there had never played it before. This is the first time. And the wind was going to change directions. It was going to be a completely different golf course on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And they're going to have to learn it, learn to play it. After Friday and Saturday, the same winds, you know, they're going to have to struggle with that. And that was going to eliminate a lot of the field.
The old story, age and guile beats youth on a bad haircut.
When I first played Lynx golf courses, I didn't like it. I hated it. The very first shot I hit was at Monifieth Golf Club, opening hole, driver, hit it right down the middle of the fairway. Went out there, couldn't find the ball.
Was this in the qualifier for
that? No, this was, actually the story goes like this. We go to Carnoustie, the very first Open Championship.
Wow.
Keith McKenzie's at the golf course where we drive up in there. There's no courtesy cars. And go out to play. And Keith comes up and introduces himself. Well, sorry, you can't play today. This is 3 days before the tournament.
And Keith is the secretary?
He's the secretary of the RNA.
Yeah.
And I said, what's the problem? He said, today's only for the qualifiers. So we had to go find a place to play.
Wow.
And so anyway, we went to Monifieth. And that first opening tee ball, bumpy drive. It was, you know, everything was burnt up in 1975 when I played at Carnoustie. It was just burnt up. And the ball hit, you know, glary, and the ball hit in the middle of the fairway. We didn't kind of see it bounce too much and went out to look for the ball. Couldn't find it. Couldn't find it. And I was playing with John Mahaffey and Hubert Green, and they hit their balls up there after looking for my ball. And so I dropped one in the middle of the fairway, hit it, and started walking to the green. I said, nah, I got to find this ball. I hit it right in the middle of the fairway. And I walked over about 50 yards to the left over there. It was a pot bunker no bigger than this table. It was in that pot bunker.
Buried.
And I said, I don't like this game. I hit a perfect shot down the middle of the fairway. It's in a pot bunker 50 yards left where it hit.
And was this the first revetted pot bunker you've ever seen?
Yeah, it was.
Did you play the proper shot with a sand wedge, splash it out, or did you try
and hit it? Picked it up and hit my provisional. That was, you know, I really did not like the game. I played the ball through the air. I hit the ball really high.
Yeah.
Really high. And how I won at the first Open, it was benign conditions for 3 days at Carnoustie. You know, after the third day, I was two or three shots off the lead. And the final day on Saturday, back in those days, it started to blow, and it blew pretty hard. And I warmed up at Monifieth. The practice facility at Carnoustie was not very good.
Non-existent.
So I used my own balls, went and hit them, picked them up, then drove over to the golf course. And I had some time to kill, and I walked by the marquee tent right there close to the first tee, and out walks Chris Schenkel and Byron Nelson.
Wow.
And at that time, I really I hadn't established much of a relationship with Byron.
He became a huge
influence. He was a very, very good, close personal friend and a mentor of mine. But we stopped to chat, and Byron was his typical, positive self. I said, you've got a good chance to win the golf tournament today. And I said, Byron, what do you think I have to shoot today? He said, you shoot even par today and you'll be right there. Yeah, because the wind was blowing.
Yeah.
And even though I was behind by two or three shots, that's what happened. I got in the playoff with Jack Newton and fortunately beat him in the playoff the next day. But, that started a wonderful, wonderful relationship with Byron.
Yeah, and a wonderful relationship with Lynx Golf, too, because you did hit the ball high and you played target golf, but you figured out how to hit it low. You hit it softly with more golf club, right?
No. I just hit it through the air.
Right again, Dave.
I just hit it through the air. I hit the ball very, very solidly, and I was always pretty good about distance. You know, I always hit the right distance. Lynx golf distance is the critical factor. Hitting the ball the right distance, because you have to play the bounce.
And that exactly, and then reading it once it's hit the ground.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And I didn't like that. I did not like that type of golf. I wanted to play the ball through the air, land it on the green, stop it. And I fought it and fought it and fought it for 3 or 4 years, even though I won a couple of Open championships. And finally, I had a conversation with myself. Don't fight it. Just play the course as it comes and what it gives you.
What's the greatest shot that you ever saw?
I saw it on TV.
Yeah.
1972.
Oh.
The United States Open, our national open.
Pebble Beach?
Pebble Beach. The blonde.
Yeah.
Golden Bear.
Yeah.
17th hole, one iron, from about 215 yards into the teeth of a wind.
Climbed up the flagstick.
And everybody's hitting three woods or drivers, and here he is hitting this one iron. And I just finished my round. I shot 76 and it passed 30 people that day.
You passed 30 people?
30 people shooting 76, four over par.
Wow.
And I'm watching on TV and I'm watching him. All he has to do is play the last two holes and one over par to win. And he hits this one iron and it hits the flagstick and he's like this. Yeah. That's the greatest shot I ever saw.
That was amazing. And I suspect the greatest shot that you ever hit was on the same hole.
Kind of on the same hole. Yeah. It's a lucky shot. Yes, it was a lucky shot. But
there was another man involved in that who meant a great deal to you, Bruce Edwards.
Bruce.
And you know, what did he say to you before you hit that?
Well, Bruce put the bag down. And actually, I had to preface that. We're walking off the tee, and I hooked this two iron to the left of the green.
And the rough was horrendous.
It was horrendous. And I walk off the tee and I mutter to him. I said, well, that's dead. You know, a little bit of a pity pot. You know how we get? Well, that's dead. And he said, come on now. Let's get it up and down. You know, that's always Bruce. Glass was always, you know, more than half full. It was always full. He said, come on, let's get it up and down. So we're walking up there. And all I was concerned about was a lie. If I had it, it was a really gnarly lie. I didn't have a chance. But I looked at the lie. It was in grass about that deep, but it was... It wasn't in gnarly grass, so I could get the club through it. And he puts the bag down. I pick out the sand wedge, and he says, get it close. And I just said to him, get it close. Hell, I'm going to hole it.
And it was straight downhill, right?
Yeah, it was downhill, broke left to right, and I took a couple of practice swings. And it's a shot I had practiced all week, because going into that tournament, I gave myself zero chance of winning that tournament the way I was playing. I was playing terribly, and I found it on Friday afternoon and started striping it. Somehow I stayed close to the first two rounds and I was there the last two rounds. That's the game of golf. And I took a couple practice swings. I hit the shot exactly the way I wanted to. It came out as softly as I could hit it, as high as I could hit it off the downslope, out of the grass. It hit on the edge of the green and started rolling to the hole.
When did you know it was going in?
Only when it hit dead center in the flagstick, and I said, don't bounce out.
Don't stay out.
Don't stay out. And he goes in the hole. And, yeah, I mean, I just about leapt to Tokyo right there.
Oh,
ran off
I mean,
the
you
side
ran
of the ground.
Around the ground. But
and then I had a second thought.
You
and
pointed
I,
at
and
Bruce.
I turn around and I look at Bruce and I say, see, I told you I was going to hole it. And he's up there going, yeah. Like that. And that was the only major championship that he won with me in the bag.
Yeah.
God rest his soul. And he died tragically of ALS.
Yeah. You were with him to the end, I know, and I know you miss him, how much he meant to you. He was a great, I spent a lot of time with him doing stuff that was no good for either of us, but he was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
He was.
Good man.
When most people think of Tom Watson, an image of him battling through a British Open squall behind a huge umbrella with maybe Bruce Edwards, his faithful caddy, at his side, that comes to mind. Or maybe him charging around the 17th green at Pebble Beach. But for me, it was a made-for-TV match between him and Jack Nicklaus on Prince Edward Island in Canada's Maritimes. Right then, right there, my life changed forever, and I got to know the real Tom Watson.
I remember 5-6 years ago, I was trying to get sober, and I had already interviewed Jack, and I was interviewing you, and I remember asking you some pointless question, and you looked at me kind of funny and put your hand over the lens, and you said, you're not well, are you? And I thought, oh, boy, here we go. I said, no, I'm not. And
you were honest.
I knew that I was going to die. I just knew that it was going to happen. I couldn't do anything about it.
You look like it.
Yeah, apparently I did, because, you know, you said to me, I said, well, you know, how do you know? And you said, I can see it in your eyes. And I said to you, what do you see? And I'll never forget it. You said, I see my reflection.
Mm-hmm. I'd been there.
Yeah, and I didn't know.
I had my struggles with alcohol, and it, I beat it by having friends help me. And that's what I was trying to do with you.
Well, you know, you said to me, you know, you should come with me. Kansas City, at which point Jack piped up and he said, "You know, you better go with him. You look like crap." And I thought to myself, you know, I'm being advised by Tom Watson, I'm being heckled by Jack Nicklaus, and Barbara and Hillary, I turned around and looked, and they're both nodding their heads like this, and I thought, maybe I'd better go. And Jack flew me down in the G5 to West Palm Beach and then over to Kansas City, and I spent a couple of days with you and Hillary, and my life has been so much better ever since. And I just remember, you know, reaching up that one last time, and yours was the warm, dry hand that helped me out, and I never really got to
thank you. It's still there.
Well, thank you.
It's still there.
It meant so much to me then, and it still does right now.
I think it's fairly obvious that was not an easy interview for me to do, but it was one that I needed to do. A friend of mine once told me that everyone knows when they were born, but only the lucky few of us ever find out why. Perhaps Tom Watson was born at least in part to be the big brother that I never had. I know it certainly feels like that to me. Thanks for joining me on this special Faherty podcast. You can get a lot more of me on Facebook, Twitter, and Faherty.com. Well, that's a scary thought.